You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we remember Sammy Jankus. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and welcome to the second episode in the Nolan Notes series. That means we are covering, in this episode, the second movie written and directed by acclaimed writer-director Christopher Nolan, Memento. Memento was a huge hit when it came out, at least critically. Daniel will tell us the context here in a little bit about the reviews and such. Box office results and all of those numbers. It is about a man who has no short-term memory. So he was attacked and his wife was attacked and his wife was raped and murdered by a man named John G. When that happened, he lost all ability to create new short-term memories. So in order to find the man who killed his wife, he has created a system of living, habits, that make it so his body responds automatically with like a muscle memory type thing, and we'll talk about some of these issues. And also, he has started tattooing himself to remember important pieces of information about the killer. As I've already mentioned, joining me on this discussion of Memento from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I feel like the pitch for this movie was basically a studio exec who was really into Guy Pearce, who needed a vehicle for him to be shirtless every scene. That's really how this movie got made. Hi.
Either shirtless or wearing way too baggy clothing.
Yes, indeed. So, what's up? Long time no
well,
talk.
I was hoping you... Yeah, Daniel's, of course, making a joke about we're recording this episode in a back-to-back session here, so it's a little behind the scenes for you listeners out there. Although, if you listen to this at a random time, that will make no sense to you. So, thanks, Daniel, for breaking the, like, eighth wall or something.
Yeah, most of
I was hoping right now.
Don't have that many walls.
That's like 16 walls.
This is how bored Daniel was by this movie.
Yes.
That he's sabotaging this entire episode. But I was hoping, you said you had all the relevant pages open. Could you tell us some things? Like, what was the Rotten Tomatoes reviewer's score versus audience score? What was the box office take, domestic versus international?
So,
all of those
Memento
things.
Came out in the year 2000, Millennium movie. And it's got a pretty high score just about everywhere. In fact, it's the number 49th highest rated movie on IMDb with a score of 8.5 there. You rarely see any movies in the 8s on IMDb. Rotten Tomatoes, it's even better for this movie, with a 92% score for the critics and a 94% audience score. As for money, it made some. In fact, its budget was a scant $9 million, and it was an R-rated movie. And domestically, it took in $25.5 million and $14 million overseas for a worldwide total of just shy of $40 million on a $9 million budget. So if you're wondering why they brought Christopher Nolan back to direct big-budget films, this is the reason. So there you go. It made money. It's highly critically acclaimed. Audiences love it. This is, by all accounts, a great movie.
One of the last movies that I think everyone agrees on. This was right before the time when everything became controversial. Even with Christopher Nolan's later Batman movies, those became philosophically and culturally controversial. If you remember some of the what does Batman stand for, what does Gotham stand for, and we'll discuss all that when we get to those movies.
Two more.
I think this is one of the last movies before the culture changed.
Agreed. Two more minor points here. This had two Academy Award nominations, one for Best Writing and Screenplay and the other for Best Editing. It didn't win either of those categories. It also had a Golden Globe for Best Screenplay, which it did not win. But that year, Christopher Nolan did win the AFI Screenwriter of the Year Award. So, this really
put
him on the map.
Yes, it was best original screenplay, even though it was based on a story his brother had done, Jonathan Nolan, but the story his brother had done had not been published yet. So this got original screenplay, even though it was an adaptation.
There you go. So,
and the adaptation is actually wildly different than this story. The adaptation, I believe, like takes place in jail or something. I don't know. I sometimes I wonder about, this is a brief sidebar, I wonder about the relationship between the Nolans. Like, I can only imagine if my brother wrote a story and then I took it and I made a movie that was better than the original story, how mad my brother would be at me. Like, do you think Jonathan secretly hates Christopher?
Well, they're brothers, so I'm sure it's not so secret.
Anyway, also joining us from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
I really enjoyed this movie, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. It's this has always been a really striking experience for me, and I think this is probably the fourth time I've watched it for this mid-side episode. So, looking forward to diving in.
All right, well, let's start by going a little bit more into our experiences with the movie. Daniel, we insinuated that you find it boring. James, we insinuated that you love it, or you just basically just said that you loved it right there. My experience is right in the middle of you two guys, so I think it'll be an interesting episode for people to listen to hear us, you know, sort of break all these things down and come to some sort of agreement. When this movie started, when I started watching it, so I have never seen this movie before. It was one of those where I didn't watch. This was, you know, when I was 2000. When in 2000 did this come out, Daniel? In the spring or the fall?
It had to be the fall because the award season was like 2001-ish. So,
okay. So, yeah, this came out my fall of my senior year of high school because I graduated spring of 01. So I was not really into watching movies and stuff back then. I mean, I watched stuff like Ready to Rumble, which was the world championship wrestling movie. So I wasn't like watching movies the same way I do now. I wasn't into that stuff. So when I heard this movie, this was a movie that like all the pretentious kids in high school, who I would still call pretentious and say they didn't really know about art, who pretend to know about art, loved this movie. And it was one of those hyped movies that I was like, ah, this is stupid. And then I heard the premise. It's like a guy with short-term memory loss tattoos himself to try and solve his wife's killing, which, by the way, I think that's an unfair summary synopsis of the movie. I really do. So I just had no inclination to watch it. So this week before recording this episode was the first time I ever saw this movie. So I sat down to watch it and I started watching it. And my initial reaction was, oh my God, are we really doing this? And it's because it's like, if you're talking about the Tarantino technique, which is where you go like, you start somewhere and then you go 3 weeks earlier and then you build back up to that point. This movie is the ultimate version of that technique. And I was like, really? Am I really going to have to sit here and do that? So in the beginning, I was very, very annoyed with this movie, especially as it flashes between the black and white and the color, and we have these two juxtaposed narratives. I was just not wanting to deal with this movie. And then as it progressed, and it got to a certain point, especially when it got to the turn, I was like, okay, I want to see where this is going. This is clearly going somewhere. It's very intentional. And then I got to the end and I said, okay, I appreciate this. I like what this did. I like what this is about. I don't know if I will ever rewatch this movie, but getting to the end and seeing the way it was executed and the end point of it, it made me appreciate everything that had come before it. So my feeling on this movie changed as I was watching it, which is very interesting. I don't usually have a lot of experiences like that. It got a lot better. So how about you guys? Daniel, what was your experience watching this movie?
Hoi vey. So without giving a review, my experience of this movie was very much that it took all of my concerted effort to continue watching this movie. It took all of the focus of my mind to continue to keep my attention onto the moving pictures on my 50-inch high-definition television, because I just could not get into it. I just was not interested. From the moment the sort of concept is revealed that we're telling this story sort of basically backwards, at least scene by scene backwards, my reaction was not like, oh, that's cool. My reaction was like, ugh, okay, I guess. And it just took all of my willpower to make it through this movie. Now, that being said, I think I'm happy that I did. I don't think it's even fair to say that I was entertained by this movie, but it was almost like going to an art exhibit by an artist who is clearly talented, but whose art I don't really like. Which is strange, because I love Christopher Nolan, and I especially love his later stuff, but this movie was like going to a Gustav Klimt exhibit, where it's like, oh, there's a lot of talent here, I just hate all of this. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So that was my experience.
Interesting. I had a very, like, that's very similar to the way I described my experience, where it's like, okay, we're really doing this? We're really telling the story in this way?
Yeah, it felt like a slog to me.
We'll talk about why. There's a very specific reason he executed it in that way, and we'll get there. Now, that doesn't mean it worked, but that means we know what he was going for. There was a why for what he was going for. So, James, you said this is the fourth time you watched this movie. So you want to give your experience with this movie?
So I've seen when I was a lot younger in, I think I was 24, I saw this movie several times, like back to back, because I thought I was just so enamored of this like plot structure. I thought it was very, it seemed to convey something about the way conscious experience, or it conveys so many different things about the way our minds work, that I just really liked that perspective. And it turns out that I was so enamored of that perspective that I did not understand the ending the first time, or, you know, the beginning the first time I watched it. So this fourth time, I actually understood the full meaning of the beginning. And we're giving spoilers, right, Justin?
I mean, if you want to spoil everything right now, go ahead. Obviously, we're going to spoil it later on, so say what you have to say.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so we're going to have full spoilers on this episode of this movie. So, and I do recommend watching the movie, because it's really cool. But anyway, on this fourth watch, I you know, realized that this is a that the protagonist is, that the entire plot is driven by the protagonist's decision to immerse himself into a fantasy. And so as a result, like, it was just a real letdown, because my first few times I had a sense of, you know, sort of admiration for the character, that he was, you know, still just trying to do his best to understand the world, even though, you know, he's suffering this terrible handicap. And he maintains a strong ideology about it. He says the world is still there when you close your eyes. The world is still out there. The truth still is. And, you know, people say, people tell him, like, well, once you've killed your wife's murderer, you're just going to forget. What does that matter? He says, well, it will be true that she's dead. And so I focused a lot more on those themes than I did than I did on the fact that he has immersed himself into a fantasy, and this whole plot just has led to him being taken advantage of, because he refuses to see even that much of the truth that he can see. So that was I've always just loved the package of this movie, the way it's delivered. But my experience was actually very dark this fourth time. I was very let down in a certain way, not because it was a bad movie, but just because it was so dark and disappointing, that beginning or ending. So that was my experience on the fourth time watching it.
It's meant to be dark. I think it's
meant absolutely.
To be dark.
That's not a criticism of the artistry of the movie. That's just my experience. It's just, it was a rough time for me. I felt very sad at the end.
You even felt sad even though you delivered that ridiculous prank to your girlfriend?
Well, the prank was planned ahead of time. I timed Alexa she's going to think I'm talking. I timed my Amazon Echo Dot to say right in the middle of the movie, this is a reminder. John G raped and murdered your wife. And so the idea being that, like, and I had that happen in the middle of the movie for as a joke to Mackenzie, because he has tattooed to his chest, John G. raped and murdered my wife. And I just thought it'd be funny if Alexa, if, you know, if Lenny were to have Alexa, it would make maybe make his life a lot easier.
Yeah, Memento set in 2018 would be a very different movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was well aware watching it. I was like, man, if this guy just had a smartphone, like, his life would be completely different.
Yeah, you could take pictures, make notes.
Yeah, just have an Instagram account where you put all the videos up.
Yeah, isn't there a site or something that does, like, what would move? How would movies be different if there were cell phones when they were made?
There's something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that for Lord of the Rings.
That's different because that's set in the past intentionally. It's supposed to be movies that are set contemporarily, and then if they had cell phones at the time. Like, there are a lot of plots that would be completely eliminated, and this is a large one of them. Although it's not. I don't think that ultimately this movie, I think it would logistically be different if there were smartphones. But I don't think the ultimate end of this movie would be different because of the theme, because of the point of this movie. And you've already alluded to this, James. So in the beginning, when I was watching this movie, I was like, wow, this is like epistemology, the movie. Like, how do you know, and what's true and does it matter versus your subjective experience? And it was discussing a lot of that. But then when we get to the end of the movie and you find out that he intentionally puts the tattoo of the guy who's not his wife's killer on him, you find out that there's a much different meaning to all of this. So to give a brief summary, he has this friend that keeps showing up in the movie, Teddy. And in the beginning of the movie, you see him killing Teddy. So at the start of the movie, you think Teddy is his wife's killer. But through the end of the movie, and we'll talk about the plot mechanic in a second and everything, what more matters right now is the ideas behind it. At the end of the movie, you find out that Teddy was actually his friend. Teddy was an undercover cop, and Teddy reveals to him that he killed his wife's killer a long time ago. He already got back at John G. And it's done, and Teddy has since then been manipulating him to make him feel like he has a sense of purpose to kill lots of John G's because there are lots of John G's in the world, and it's also lined up with Teddy's job as a cop. So Teddy's basically been using this guy as a hitman to achieve these ends and to make money and get nice cars and everything. And Teddy reveals, even my name is John G. So you could say that I was the killer. And that's what Lenny, the main character, does. He then has the license plate for Teddy's car, tattooed on his leg. And when he does that, he then forgets that Teddy wasn't the killer, and then we see that eventually it ends up with him killing Teddy. But the reason he does this is because he does not want to live in a world where he doesn't have that sense of purpose. He would rather have that sense of purpose, that he's continually trying to look for his wife's killer, than to not have that. So the movie actually, to me, at the end, becomes about evasion. This is the guy who has the most ability to evade. He has literally no short-term memory, so it's very easy for him. So he's in a heightened situation. So for the rest of us, we still have to be vigilant about what we know, and we have to remember Sammy Jenkins, right? He has that tattoo that he remembers Sammy Jenkins. And the point of that is he has to remind himself to be vigilant, to keep with his systems that make it so his body has muscle memory, to keep with the search he's doing so he doesn't forget what he's doing. That's what Remember Sammy Jenkins is. He was an insurance adjuster, and one of his former cases had short-term memory loss as well. And he fucked up his life with the short-term memory loss, although there's some weird stuff with that as well. And Leonard has that tattoo to remind himself to remember Sammy Jenkins, which is basically don't evade, accept reality. Except the irony is at the end of the movie, he does not do that. So to me, that is the point of Memento. It's a, it's an entire discussion, portrayal of the way we remember things and the way we process information perceptually and conceptually, and then what we do with it and how we make value judgments off of it. And it's very clearly condemning evasion and showing how evil of a sin it is, because he killed the person who was kindest to him throughout the entire movie. Everybody else in the movie treats him like shit, but the guy who was kindest to him, he ends up killing because of his intentional evasion. He killed Teddy on purpose, because Teddy was the one who revealed to him about reality. Teddy revealed to him that his wife survived the attack, and he was the one who killed her because she had diabetes and she tried to test him with insulin to see if he would keep giving her the shot, because she thought he was faking it, and he kept giving her the shot and she overdosed. So because he wanted to evade that fact, that's ultimately what he was evading. I apologize earlier. I said he wanted to live in a world with purpose. He wanted to live in the world with that purpose because he was doing it to evade the fact that he killed his wife. And he punished the person who wasn't letting him evade that. So ultimately, I think it's a movie that's against evasion and very pro-reality, but it shows the difficulty that we as humans have in perceiving and conceiving reality. And that's actually something that we see later and in a better way in Inception. So Christopher Nolan will return to these themes in a later movie. What do you guys think of that analysis on my part? Do you agree that's the theme? Do you disagree?
I definitely agree that that's the theme. And I mean, it was it was such a disappointment to sort of realize that on this fourth viewing and actually understanding what the movie was about, that, you know, Lenny was not a virtuous character. He was just so, but he's inconsistent on this point. There's times where he says like the world is still there when you're not looking, and that which is like the ultimate argument against evasion, like, oh, well, pretending doesn't make it different. And similarly, he at one point, and sort of the parallel to that in the plot itself is that at one point in the middle of things, Lenny says, I think someone's screwing with me. I think someone's trying to get me to kill the wrong guy. But that somebody was him in the past, who it was him in the past when he decided, oh, I don't want Teddy telling me about what reality, the way reality really is. I resent that. Like, I'm going to set myself up to kill him eventually. And although part of what made it a little difficult for me to understand the first three times I watched it was because Teddy was actually still taking advantage of Lenny, because he was using Lenny to kill criminals for him. So, like, Teddy was not entirely Leonard's friend. And so I thought that he was getting back at him for using him to kill criminals. So he says, like, well, you know what? Fuck you. Like, I'm going to set myself up to kill you eventually. That's what I thought he was.
Interesting. That's something that Christopher Nolan said when I was reading about this movie. Christopher Nolan said that people at the end, he didn't anticipate, people at the end had a hard time accepting what Teddy was saying was the truth. A lot of people thought Teddy was lying and that he was the killer. And that's why Lenny killed him. That's why Leonard killed him. And that's because of what you're saying. Something that Nolan gets really right in this movie is human psychology and the human urge to self-deceive. And I didn't say instinct, I said urge. People want to self-deceive because it's easier. It's easier to pretend reality isn't the way it is. And we see that in Leonard, where he recognizes correctly, and I think we're supposed to take it correctly, that, yeah, justice exists even if we don't remember it. Even if the killer is dead, we don't remember it. And, you know, at the end of the movie, justice is served, right? Lenny is going to continue to suffer in perpetuity for his sins. And I don't mean that in the Christian sense. I mean that for what he's done wrong. The killer is dead. And, you know, he's partially the killer of his wife and he's suffering. He's basically living in eternal limbo because of that. And so justice is served. So I think we're supposed to take that as true. The idea that the world still exists outside of myself. I'm just doing my best I can to understand it with my limitations. So we identify with that and we go, hey, this is a good guy. He's really trying. And we empathize with him because of what he's been through and losing his wife and losing his entire life, basically. And part of the plot mechanic, and again, in a couple seconds, the plot mechanic is designed in a way to make us empathize with him and understand him. So when you get to the end, you don't want to believe that what Teddy is saying is true. You yourself want to evade it. And I think that speaks to the success of the film, the fact that you want to evade it as well. And you want to go, no, there's no way Teddy could be right. There's no way Teddy can be right. But you know he's right because Leonard always tells the Remember Sammy Jenkins story. And as he's killing the drug dealer at the end, the drug dealer says, Remember Sammy. Do you remember Sammy? And that is the clue you need to know that in reality, that is not the killer and what Teddy is saying is true. Teddy even references that. Yeah, you know, he knew you, blah, blah, blah. And then he tells everything. So you want to, but it's almost a test of the audience's character. Are you willing to evade reality and take him as the hero still? Or are you willing to accept what Teddy is saying and accept the reality of the situation? It's very interesting, and I think that's intentional.
From an artistic... I'm just going to just short point. From an artistic filmmaking standpoint, it would be inconsistent of Christopher Nolan to be implying that Teddy is lying at the end because we only believe that Teddy is lying because it's written on the back of the photo, but in that final scene, it gets written on the back of the photo after Lenny makes the conscious choice to off Teddy. So,
right.
You have to, from an artistic, if you're reading the art correctly, you have to believe that Teddy is telling the truth in that last scene.
Wait, you just said right. You can read art correctly, Daniel?
Yes, we do take that stance on this show.
Teddy also has no motivation to lie at that point.
Yeah.
Whereas in every other scene where Teddy does lie, Teddy lies plenty. He starts talking, you know, at one point he's calling Lenny up and asking him about clues and stuff and asking him about the case. And then at another point, Teddy says, hey, what about that? Were you receiving calls in your hotel from some cop who's trying to fuck with you? Like, you know, Teddy's fucking with him too, but it's just that Teddy doesn't have any motive to lie during that scene. So we can assume, and then there's also flashbacks that Lenny has that indicates that, like, oh wait, like I did inject my wife with insulin, or did I pinch her leg? I forget. Like why would he misremember in that particular case if it was that he was trying to block out those memories and change them? So,
yeah.
And I actually read a review. I read a review after this of a guy who he himself could not, could not handle the fact that Lenny was an evader. I read one review where the guy said, oh, well, and we all know that Teddy was lying at the end. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, no, that's not what happened. Like, that's what I used to think happened when I couldn't really understand the plot. But when you look at it, you know, a fourth time, I guess it's pretty, I think it's pretty clear. Yeah. By the fourth time.
Yeah.
Daniel, were you going to say something?
No, I don't think so. I think that summarized, I think that is the theme. I think that's the theme, although I would maybe loosen the benevolence a little bit at this point. I don't think there's a ton of evidence to think that the theme is that benevolent. It might be that, you know, it's bad to evade reality, but we all do it anyway, or something like that. It might be a little more malevolent than we're giving him. So,
what about the other characters? What about them? Is evidence that they're evading reality? Because he would have to be showing that through the other characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think every character in this is lying in some way and manipulating Lenny in some way, right?
And that's evasion?
I think it's instead of
But that's not depicted as being okay.
Instead of dealing with their own lives the way they're supposed to, they're basically manipulating this guy to deal with it in some underhanded way for them. I think the best example of that is Natalie, who is revealed in that one epic scene to be ultimately a huge liar. which is my mm-hmm. favorite scene in the whole movie. But.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So that's your favorite scene in the whole movie. So let's talk about that. And let's talk about that in two basic ways. So there's one very major stylized thing that Christopher Nolan does in this movie, and it's tied into his approach to filmmaking, which I don't remember if I talked about this in the following episode, but that sounds very, very confusing. In the episode on the movie The Following, it's short. The following episode sounds like it's going to be the next episode of the Nolan Notes. I don't believe I talked about this, but I intended to. This actually goes to The Prestige. So, first of all, what he does here is part of the movie is told forwards, and that's in black and white. So the part that's told linearly is in black and white, and the part that's told backwards is in color. I think this is done intentionally to mimic Leonard's life. Whereas when he's living forwards, that is what life is like for him. It's not a full life. It's very much in black and white. He doesn't know what's going on. It's not real. It's not the same way we experience life. Something is missing. I think that's why Christopher Nolan did it in black and white. And this is before the reveal of the black and white is leading up to the reveal of Teddy saying your wife's killer is already dead, and actually you're the one who killed your wife with the insulin shots. That's what that's leading up to. Now, the stuff that's told backwards is in color. And I think that's in color because that is literally Leonard's experience. Leonard's experience, that's the life he experiences. It's full. So that's why we identify with him, because we experience life as he does. We experience the story as he does. And that is also leading up to the moment Teddy reveals that his wife's killer is dead. And actually, he killed her with the insulin shots, he being Leonard. And the reason that's his experience is we don't know what came before. We're only experiencing each snippet as it is, as it's happening. So it's like we have short-term memory loss every time we have to start over. And it's very much like that experience. So they meet in the middle. So that's the plot dichotomy, the plot dynamic here, the plot logistics here. They meet in the middle, and then they become one. And they become one in a very interesting way. It's funny that I'm calling him Lenny when he didn't want anyone to call him Lenny the whole movie, but I think that's because I have such a lack of respect for him that I just want to disrespect him. But he takes the picture of the drug dealer he just killed. And as he does, in the black and white, he takes that picture, and as he shakes it, it becomes color. And then the two movies merge together.
Yeah.
Now, in the beginning of the movie, he shakes the photo, and it undevelops. So what we have here is what Christopher Nolan talks about in The Prestige. Every great magic trick has three parts to it. The pledge, the turn, and the prestige. The pledge is where you promise what's going to happen. The turn is where everything changes, everyone's expectations are undermined. And the prestige is the reveal where everyone goes, wow, that's the trick. This is what the trick is all about. So here, the promise is the picture in reverse, undeveloping, because later it develops. The turn is, through the first half of the movie, you think that Teddy is the bad guy and Natalie is the good guy. Then, halfway through about, that's flipped, and you realize that Natalie is the bad guy and Teddy is the good guy, as in, none of them are really good people, but as in Natalie is really his enemy and Teddy is really his friend. And then you get to the end and the prestige is the reveal that, holy shit, he's been an evader the whole time. So this is a magic trick, and we see two major things that Christopher Nolan always does. We see his use of the magic trick and the three acts. He uses three acts. Movies have three acts. He uses the three parts of a magic trick to mimic that, to have his big reveal. And also we see his postmodern approach to narrative and story structure, where it's a story cut in half and told in opposite directions that meets in the middle at the end of the movie.
Yep, I agree with that, which I think is why, in my opinion, the scene with Natalie, where she, you first think she's been beaten up by Dodd, and then it reveals that she baited Lenny into beating her up, is my favorite scene in it, because it interwines all these amazing storytelling elements into one visually concrete scene. It's the best visual storytelling in the movie to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is definitely when I changed from being disinterested to interested. Because I was like, okay, this suddenly became a lot more complex, and I want to see where this is going and where the reveal is. Although you just hit on an interesting critique of this movie. What really I find fascinating about this movie and following is how non-visual they are. I mean, they are visual in the sense that you're watching them, and this one is a bit more visual and is stylized with the black and the white versus the color. But if you look at Christopher Nolan's later movies, he's much more of a quote-unquote visualist. So the fact that he went from Memento and Following to The Prestige to the Batman trilogy to Inception is just amazing to me.
Yeah, certainly. If you had said chart the trajectory of this guy's work based on his first two movies, it would have not been into blockbuster, visually stunning movies. It would have been more Darren Aronofsky. That's what I would have guessed.
Right, yeah. No, but, oh man, I mean, this, it's not needless, this movie to contrast it with just sheer nihilism, it's not any darker than it has to be to make the point it's trying to make.
I don't think it's dark.
And it's very well integrated in its own way. It's not disintegration for its own sake. It's breaking things up in order to put them back together again. And there's this intense sense of integration, literally, like, you don't know what's happening because, you know, you as the viewer are suffering from a kind of memory loss in the same way that as Leonard is. But then at the end, it all comes together. And then, of course, also there's, you know, there's the delightful twist of a drama occurring in reverse, where you first are led to think that Natalie is a victim, that Leonard helps, and then later you realize that Natalie is manipulated. And then just in the scene exactly after that one, which chronologically comes before that one, you realize that she's manipulating him, and she literally tells him to his face. That is just so delightfully dramatic for me. That I agree that that's the most interesting set of scenes in the story. And that, just when I first saw that years ago, I was just mind blown.
So
love, yeah, that
the
integration.
The way he plays with perception, how she baits him into beating her up, then she gets in the car and sits there and waits until his memory reboots, basically, and wipes itself and comes back in and acts like the victim. But when you're watching it, it looks like she literally just came from being beat up. It doesn't look like she just came from sitting in the car in the driveway. The amount of intelligence and ability it takes to execute that is astounding.
It's also to pre-think that she would have also had to have gotten rid of all the writing utensils in the room, for instance.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So he couldn't write down what actually happened.
Yeah, he showed her going around taking all the pens. Yeah.
So, very interesting, all that. So I don't want to proclaim that this is nihilistic, and my only comment about Aronofsky is because typically, I don't know, maybe it's my own perception that you sort of get the best of directors at the beginning of their career, and then it tapers off into insanity. So if I were to judge by these first two, I would have thought, like, oh, this is the high point of the benevolence of Christopher Nolan, and we're only going to get worse from here. But it's also partially because this movie, while not nihilistic, to me is very malevolent universe. And I think Nolan has a little bit of that going forward, but it comes from literally the name of the movie. The name of the movie is Memento, which is based on the short story Memento Mori, which is literally a Christian, like an old medieval Christian theory of, like, you should remember from time to time that you're going to die. Like, and the point of it being, like, to reflect on why all this that we do here is basically meaningless. Now it's sort of tied with Stoicism now, which is much more uplifting, like you know, do your best while you're here because this is it or whatever it is. But like back then, it was not about that. It was basically like, you shouldn't pursue earthly things because we're all going to die anyway. What's the point? You should look to God. So that's why I don't read it as benevolently as you do, Justin, although I don't think it's nihilistic at all.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. And I think what supports your point more is Inception. And I'll get to that in a second. But I think if you take this movie on its own, I think this movie on its own is simply a warning against evasion. It's saying, you know, we are fallible and we do have problems with memory and everything, but we must try our hardest not to evade. And that's why I don't think it's a dark movie. I think the idea that the main character evades is dark, but I think the movie itself is meant more as a motivational movie as far as what we should do with our own lives and how to live our best life. So I don't think it's dark in that way, and I don't think it's nihilistic in that way, because it's how can we best pursue values. But Christopher Nolan's approach to how we can pursue values is very interesting, because it borders on subjectivism and relativism, but I don't know if it's there yet, and we can discuss it more when we get to the Inception episode. But very briefly, the point of the end of Inception is that as long as you choose to live in the world as you see it, that is what matters. It doesn't matter if we can actually perceive the true reality. It just matters that we work towards perceiving what the reality we see as if it is true. And if you apply that to this, then we get to what you're saying, Daniel. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, somewhat. And again, I don't want to use words like, you know, use words like dark. I'm not certainly want to use dark. I want to use specifically malevolent. I don't think it has to be dark to be malevolent.
Yeah,
there's something we could explore.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm saying that this movie is not malevolent, is what I'm saying. I think it's meant to be a warning. I think it becomes more malevolent when you look at the ending of Inception, which is basically saying we can't know if we actually know the true reality.
Well, I think there's a little bit of that in this movie, to be fair, actually. So there's a scene where he's driving and he's looking at stores. And I forget the exact dialogue. I wish I had it in front of me. I wish I had written it down. But it's something like, all of us need some sort of reflection to tell us where we are because we can't really know. That's sort of...
Aha!
That's...
I have that here. On WikiQuote, you're talking about at the end.
Yeah, it's toward the end.
Where he said, yeah, the mirror, where he says, I have to believe in a world outside my own mind. I have to believe that my actions still have meaning, even if I can't remember them. I have to believe that when my eyes are closed, the world's still there. Do I believe the world's still there? Is it still out there? Yeah. We all need mirrors to remind ourselves who we are. I'm no different now. Where was I?
Yeah.
So remember, this is after he's chosen to evade. So are you interpreting that as saying that he's trying to use a mirror to hold up to himself, but because of his faulty short-term memory, he can't even remember where he is?
Yeah, it's...
So you're saying that the main character is meant to represent us?
I don't even want to go that far, but I think it is a little more of the thing in Inception that you're talking about, which is essentially like, well, it does, you know, maybe if I just believe something is out there, even though he just made the choice previously to sort of screw with his own reality, like, then that's sort of as best as I can do. That's the malevolent part to me.
Okay, you're saying that I'm interpreting it more benevolently because I am condemning the main character, where you're saying, because Christopher Nolan is more sympathetic towards that character at the end, where even though he's evading, he's trying his best, that the movie becomes malevolent.
Yeah, there's something like, there's basically just nothing we can do about our own inability to have genuine reflections of the world. It's just, we just have to try. But there's nothing we can do ultimately.
Yeah. I find that very convincing, actually, Daniel. And it actually leads me to a much, like, worse interpretation of this movie, actually.
Yeah, you can think, like, that's what I was going for. Ruining everyone's fun.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, we gotta see the movie for what it actually is. This is a hypothesis. I don't think you're gonna like this, Justin. if we keep going along this line, then that makes this movie, I think, fundamentally Kantian.
Ooh.
And I mean something very specifically by that. I don't mean like I don't like it. I'm an objectivist and I don't like it. I mean something very specific, which is Kant came after Hume. Hume's philosophy basically said, like, we can't understand anything about the world because there's no valid way to integrate it. And Kant said this. He said, well, there's a simple solution to that. Why should we be concerned with the world? Why don't we simply, instead of studying this world out there that you guys keep being preoccupied with, why don't we simply take the world to be whatever is in our own minds, and we just try to understand that. So I think this movie, maybe its ending, if you interpret it a certain way, is fundamentally Kantian in this way, where he's saying, look, I don't know what reality – there's no way to know what reality actually is, but I have to believe that the world is a certain way. So I'm going to give myself a certain reflection to tell myself who I am. I'm going to create a fantasy that defines who I am. I don't want to deal with the fact that I accidentally killed my wife. I would much rather have this romanticized plot where I'm tracking down her killer. That's the reality I'm choosing.
Yeah, and I think that that's a very possible interpretation, and I'm going to think about some of the evidence here in a second. But before we do that, I want to say that if that is the theme and it is more Kantian, then I'm saying it's more objectivist, you're saying it's more Kantian. If it is, that doesn't mean the film is any less well made. No. And it also doesn't mean the film doesn't portray evasion negatively. It's more sympathetic towards evasion, certainly. So I'm not going to think less of the movie. I'm not going to think less of the movie artistically, but I might like it less. And I'm probably not going to watch it again anyway. So it's just sort of like how I would reflect on the movie differently. The question I would have for this. Go ahead.
Oh, one final note just is along this same line of evidence. Teddy says, hey, so you lie to yourself so you can be happy. Everyone does that. He says, like, even Teddy's okay with it, basically, in a certain sense. And Teddy is supposed to be the voice of reason. He's the only character in the entire movie who ever tells the truth at any time, really. He's the only person who ever speaks what actually is the truth. And then he also has an interesting line where he says, you should be investigating yourself instead of investigating this murder.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very... That was a very it's like Teddy's his conscience, basically.
To take a very brutalist approach to that, James, and I'm not sure Jess will like this approach either. I'm not sure I like it. But, like, the guy, I mean, this Lenny is a guy who admits to everyone he has short-term memory loss, and literally everyone in the world that this guy lives in decides to take advantage of him because of it. And then the one guy who has any modicum of truth telling, Lenny decides to kill that guy. Now that's a very brutalist sort of hardcore interpretation. It's not very nuanced whatsoever, but I think it goes a little bit overall to the malevolence of the plot here.
Certainly.
Well, I mean, I think you're taking it in broad strokes, and that is what happens. It's this severe injustice that comes from his evasion.
Yeah.
Right, and that's why I have trouble walking off the line from the objectivist interpretation to the Kantian interpretation. Because within the world, his life is made worse by the evasion.
Yeah.
And that's why I have trouble going towards the Kantian approach. I mean, maybe it's a mix where it's forgiving of him because we're all Kantian in that way. But at the same sense, it is saying that in objective reality, our life... I mean, okay, maybe this is a better way of saying it. Isn't it one of you, maybe it was James, who said that Christopher Nolan has a malevolent universe premise? Maybe Nolan Absolutely. Has a malevolent universe premise that the world isn't good for us because even as hard as we try, we're not able to live in a good world. And maybe this is just an example of that.
And it's
I think I would split it up. Let's get back. Just a quick note on the idea of dark versus, or like the, these phrases, dark and malevolent. I think it helps to separate different aspects of a film's sense of life. I think a film can be dark in the way of like literally dark, where like you can't see what's going on. I prefer, in that sense, I prefer to use the word unintelligible. And then you can talk about dark insofar as like a dark mood, as though like, oh, well, happiness is difficult or impossible in this world. I would call that, I call that malevolent. I mean, you could use whatever word you want, but these are just, and then another possible interpretation of dark is that man is fundamentally evil. And I don't think Nolan holds that. And you can also say dark in that man can't do anything about his world. Like, he's just determined to do that. And Nolan certainly doesn't think that way. He definitely has characters who make choices. I would say Nolan is dark insofar as like he portrays a dark universe where happiness is difficult or even impossible sometimes to find.
But
I don't think he says happiness is impossible, though. He may say difficult, but I do not think he says impossible.
It depends on the film. I think in this one he says impossible because we're not given any sort of something that's notable about the point about evasion too. There's no alternative presented. It's not like we're able to glimpse what his life would have been like if he didn't evade. It's just sort of like, well, he evaded, but you know, well, everyone lies to themselves to be happy. How else are you supposed to navigate this topsy-turvy world of ours?
I agree with that statement that we're not given an alternative, but what you just said at the end there is that to be happy. So even though he evades, he is happy at the end. And that is the difference where I think Nolan is saying, and we see this at the end of Inception with Cobb's choice as well, that Nolan is saying happiness is possible. It just may not be happiness in the objectivist sense. It may be happiness in the Kantian sense.
Yeah, maybe. That's a hell of a thing. It's a hell of a thing to say about a director I really like. But I mean, you know, I'm going to choose the world that exists. I'm going to choose the Nolan that exists, not the Nolan I want.
The Nolan that exists.
Or the Nolan I deserve.
Well, to be fair, you know, our first, hold on, Dan. Our first series here was on the Snyder series. And if I had to pick a director who was more objectivist and a director who's more Kantian, I would definitely say that Snyder is more objectivist and Nolan is more Kantian. And maybe that's the difference between the two. And maybe that's why I like Snyder more.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, well, this is early in his filmmaking career. We'll have to see how these themes explore or else. But I would say that even in this movie, there's a stark contrast between the malevolence of Memento and the malevolence of Black Swan, where Black Swan,
yes,
people are evil, the world is unintelligible, happiness is impossible, kill yourself. Literally.
Yeah.
And in this movie, it's more like, okay, it might be really hard to deal with the world, maybe even impossible, but like, that sucks. Do your best. So it's more like really reluctant malevolence or very ennui about the malevolence. So I don't think he's a full-throated nihilist, certainly.
No. He definitely believes in free will, and he definitely has, I think the integration inherent in all of his movies, except maybe the first one so much, but like even the first one, like there's a heavy element of integration, just having all these pieces come together. I think he believes in a intelligible universe.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't think he thinks it's impossible. I just think if we take Leonard as representing all of us, then it's just really, 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 really difficult because memory is faulty. I think that's what he would be saying if I had to distill it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
So is there anything else we want to say about this movie, about the acting, about the music, anything of that nature?
I liked all the actors in this movie except Guy Pearce. I thought he was bizarre. In fact, I think I would have liked it better if someone else had done the voiceovers. If someone else was Guy Pearce's consciousness. The voiceovers to me were very wimpy and strange, comparatively. But the rest of the acting I thought was very strong. The music was interesting. Christopher Nolan, clearly from this, is a very talented director. But again, just not a piece of art that I liked. Didn't respond to it.
Acting-wise, for me, this is one of those where it's interesting to watch something knowing what we know today versus when it came out. The guy who played Sammy Jenkins was in Silicon Valley, and I kept picturing him as the guy from Silicon Valley. And then did you notice when they were giving Sammy Jenkins the test, too, to see if he would remember based on muscle memory who was testing him?
I don't know. I didn't recognize him, at least.
Oh, it was the comedian Tom Lennon.
Oh, it was.
Right. So I'm like, he's playing this completely serious, like, research scientist role. And Tom Lennon's like the biggest fucking goofball on the planet. So I'm watching this and I'm like, yeah, that's a ridiculous role knowing who that guy becomes.
The Reno 911 guy.
Yes.
Yes. Sammy Jenkins is a Stephen Tobolowsky, who is also a goofball in most everything he plays.
Right. Right, so it was very hard. Like, I wanted to believe he was faking because I was like, yeah, that fits with that kind of actor.
I actually really liked that choice because you have a hard time taking Sammy Jenkins completely seriously. He comes off as just a complete victim. Just kind of, he has that just expression of just like, oh, I'm just here and I just don't know what's going on. I thought he was well cast.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I liked, that when Leonard later on realizes that, he said that whenever he saw Sammy, there would be a look of recognition in Sammy's eyes, and that made him think, you know, he wasn't truly had the issue he had. He was faking it. He wasn't truly having issues with short-term memory. And then later, Leonard says, I realize that that's you just fake it. Like, you think you're supposed to know that person, so you just fake it. And I think we've all, and maybe that's a minor evasion I've done, but we've all been in that situation where it's like, I'm supposed to know this person. I mean, personally, tutoring, sometimes I have a student 1 week and don't remember them the second week because I've only met them once. And then I have to pretend like I remember what we did last week. And like, I ask them questions and stuff to have them tell me. I'm like, I have to pretend to know their name and stuff. Like, oh, hey, how you doing? You have a good week? Blah, blah, blah. And I like pretend like I have this familiarity with them. So I think we've all been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
One thing that I come away with this is just a stronger impression and a stronger appreciation of Christopher Nolan and how deeply he thinks about these, about just psychology and how the mind works. And I don't mean in a necessarily a scientific sense, but just introspectively, he asks so many questions about how our perceptual and conceptual experience is. I don't think he has many correct answers there, but like he asks so many questions and really develops those themes to a full bodied in a fully integrated sense in his movies, and just gets you to think about these things. There's not many movies can really get you to consistently think about something that you don't usually think about. It raises the issues of like, how does the mind work very concretely? And I always loved that about this movie.
And, oh, 100%.
Yeah, 100%. The Matrix is like that too.
Well, except the Matrix does in the other two movies degenerate into full-blown Christian, self-sacrificial, collectivist relativism. So that's a whole other thing. In regards to what you're saying, I agree completely. I agree 100%. And since we already opened the door by throwing around words like Kantian and objectivist, and you made a comment earlier, this is why I have problems with people, and this is seen often in objectivists, who will throw out the baby with the bathwater. And what I mean by that is the fact that we even hinted at the fact that Nolan might be a Kantian or have a Kantian perspective would make many objectivists denounce him and say he is a terrible filmmaker and he's not worthwhile and he's evil. But I think that's underplaying and ignoring and in a way evading, ironically, the subtlety and the complexity of his movies and the complexity of human psychology. Because if there's one thing this movie shows us, it's that through Leonard, we can hold contradictory ideas without realizing it. On one hand, Leonard holds the idea of reality matters, and we must live in line with reality, and what happens in reality matters even if I don't know it. But on the other hand, he evades reality, which is saying my psychology is what is most important. So he holds both of those ideas without realizing it. And I think when you are so quick to condemn and throw out the baby with the bathwater, you miss the positives of other people that you wouldn't always get. And this is this movie stands as an example as for me, why I can say, okay, I disagree with things or it's not exactly how I would have done it, but this is still a good piece of art that I got a high level of enjoyment from.
Yeah.
A couple minor.
And another thing worth noting.
Yeah. Go ahead, James.
Oh.
Another thing worth noting is that I don't think Nolan is sort of, Nolan's not a philosophy professor. He's an artist who focuses all of his time in conveying to us his experience, his perspective. He's not primarily concerned with developing a perspective. And his perspective is that of taking a lot of, I mean, if he is indeed Kantian, then his perspective, if we're right here, then his perspective demonstrates sort of taking a lot of our Kantian habits that we've developed in the 21st century and just applying them consistently and looking at reality with that. And how do you find meaning and purpose and happiness and truth in a world where that's your mindset? And even though Nolan doesn't give us the tools to think our way out of that trap, he at least shows us what it's like to be in that trap. So I think we should listen, even if we don't necessarily agree.
Yeah, and Daniel, one second, you can go. But I haven't taken a side on whether he's Kantian or more objectivist. I just want to.
I haven't either. I'm saying if he is in fact Kantian.
We will track that going forward because there are many more Nolan movies to watch. So Daniel, what did you want to say?
There are just a few minor notes or things that are interesting about the film that I looked up, and then also I looked up a lot about the marketing, which was revolutionary. But so like a couple things, like one, Brad Pitt was initially cast as Leonard.
I would have liked that better.
He wanted to do it, but there was a scheduling conflict, and so he ended up not being able to do it. Aaron Eckhart was another choice. He ended up not being able to do it.
But he later becomes Harvey Dent, so that's interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. A lot of the sound effects in the movie are played backwards, especially like gunshots and stuff. Like the sound effect is just played backwards. So even in integrating in sound design, Nolan has to be admired for his artistry, which is interesting. And then finally, one of the things about this movie that I remember a little bit when it came out, but sort of revisiting, a lot of things were rushed in my mind. They did a ton of marketing stuff, like the website, the official website was not like an informational website. It was a game, basically, that you click on newspaper clippings and you highlight certain things and you get more information to sort of flesh out the story of this thing. And then even like the special edition DVD menu was a psychological examination where you had to highlight certain items in the right order to access the special stuff on the DVD. So they did a lot of innovative things, and it was integrated from beginning to end, which I really appreciate from Nolan. So,
all right then. So I don't think there's much left to say here. Did we like this better? Is this a better film or worse film than Following?
What? So we're ranking on objectively, is it a better or worse film, and not just our subjective, did we like it more or less, right?
You can do both if you want.
Because I think it is an objectively better film than Following. So if you were to rank it that way, number one would be Memento, number two would be Following. In terms of pure enjoyment, I enjoyed Following more, honestly, than this film, just in terms of entertainment value. So.
Can you say why? Can you explain that a little?
It was more riveting. The scenes unfurled in a more interesting way to me. It didn't feel as clunky. And I don't know, just the sort of sense of life reaction following felt a little less malevolent than this one, although still malevolent. But Memento is an James? Objectively better movie.
I agree. Memento is a objectively better movie, and I just enjoyed it more. I loved mostly what I love about this is the integration out of chaos. He smashes reality into a million pieces and then brings it together in a way I've never seen it brought together again. So that's I think fundamentally what I enjoy about this movie.
I agree. I think Memento is an objectively better movie, and I enjoy this more than Following because I think it's sort of the better version of Following. I think it's Following on steroids with a bigger budget. It's a longer movie, similar themes, that similar ideas, is shot in a similar way. It's all very, very similar. It's sort of like you said, Daniel, when you have a band at the beginning and they release an EP. And then the LP is just a longer, better version of the EP. That's very much how I felt with Memento. And also, this is the first time we really see Christopher Nolan's use of the magic trick approach to filmmaking with the Pledge, The Turn, and The Prestige. And I love magic. I'll always love magic. And that's part of the reason I enjoy watching Christopher Nolan movies. Is I do love just the pure experience of getting to the end there and being like, oh, wow. And like, I did enjoy that final scene where it's like, his friend's name, Teddy. It's interesting that they had similar names there and he didn't want to be, wow, I just picked that up. He didn't want to be called Lenny and that's similar to Teddy. There's interesting stuff going on there, but that's neither here nor there. So maybe somebody can write us in and tell us what they thought about that. But at the end where Teddy reveals the truth and then we see how it affects Lenny and how it reveals and changes the perception of everything. I enjoy that experience because the same reason I enjoy magic. There's not many things in life anymore that can just upend my understanding of everything that came before it. And I have to quickly reassess it and put all the pieces back together like that to understand the theme and understand what just happened. And I just intellectually, I enjoy that experience. It's a different experience than I get from most other films and most other filmmakers.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yep, agreed.
All right. We will next cover Insomnia is Christopher Nolan's next movie. However, this next movie is interesting because it is one he directed, but he did not write. So it'll be really interesting to watch and discuss Insomnia. That will be the next edition of the Nolan Notes. But for now, this concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and remember Sammy Jenkins.
Day, have.